Normally, we here at AZMcast try very hard to stick to the basics, mostly because I can't understand a whole lot of complicated things. But this month, we're taking a foray into the new frontier of emergency medicine with ultrasound-guided hemodynamic resuscitation. Do you like ultrasound? Sure, me too. Are you willing to stake your patient's life on your ultrasound skills? Yeah, me neither. Because of this, our ultrasound and critical care faculty have come up with a flowchart of bedside cardiac ultrasounds that will help to guide fluid and pressor resuscitation for that pesky patient who's just too sick for traditional guesswork care. To the untrained eye, like mine, this flowchart reads a bit like an insurance formulary, or the tax code, so we invited its creators to help explain it in a way that hopefully simplifies it a bit so that you can use it to take better care of your patients. The times, they are changing, and we need to keep up, so let's get to some ultrasound-guided hemodynamic resuscitation.
Hey, it's Dr. Mosier.
Hey, Dr. Mosier, how are you?
I'm good, man. It's been a while since I've heard your voice.
Yeah. You been on vacation?
Yeah.
I've been working.
Oh, good.
Where have you been?
I've been around. What do you got?
Oh, I got a lady. She's 84 years old. She's coming in with sepsis, I think. She's got a fever, and she just didn't look great. She came in pretty tachycardic. I thought it might have been from her heart. She's got AFib and congestive heart failure, she's got a dialysis catheter. I'm pretty sure that's where her source is. So I gave her some antibiotics, gave her 4 liters of fluid, and now she'll be ready to come up to you soon. So,
4 liters? How'd she respond to that?
She's not saying much at all. I mean, she's pretty sick.
Well, what's her last blood pressure?
60. She's 60 over 40 right now. I can give her another 4 liters if you want to.
Well, why don't you start some pressors or something?
I heard on a podcast one time you can just give anyone with sepsis 4 liters. They should be getting better. So pressors, that's kind of your thing, man. I'll let you screw around with whatever micrograms or stuff that you do. But
have you looked at her heart? How's her heart look?
On the x-ray, it looks pretty big. It looks like the Grinch. She's got a pneumonia starting to blossom now, too. So I think that maybe pneumonia and the vascular.
On ultrasound, have you looked at her heart on ultrasound?
Oh, you know, I'm not credentialed to do ultrasounds on hearts. I can do eyes and like soft tissue. I found this cactus thorn last week in this like 20-year-old guy, and man, about 2.5 hours of digging around, I finally got it. But so I got the cactus thorn out, and it's a great story.
So 2.5 hours.
2.5 hours.
But you don't have time to put in a line and start pressors.
You guys do lines, right? Are you not comfortable doing the lines? Should I transfer them someplace else?
Well, you tell me. You have a barely conscious elderly lady with heart failure and renal failure who's on dialysis. You give 4 liters of fluid to 60 over 40. Kind of sounds like that patient needs to be fixed.
Well, yeah, the way you say it, she sounds really sick, so she probably needs the ICU. So we're going to put in a bed slip for her. We'll get her upstairs. Wait. Okay, she's getting hypoxic now, and she's having trouble breathing. I'm going to intubate her, then she'll definitely need the unit. All right, we'll call you back, okay?
All right.
Jared, it's nice to have you back.
Thank you. Sorry I've been gone for a while.
Yeah, you've been doing busy stuff. What you been up to? You've been building an EDICU.
Trying.
You've been trying to get better ways of getting oxygen into the tissues besides what we're doing.
Yeah, working on a mouse model of ARDS and drug development to try to be a better hemoglobin of sorts.
That's great, man. Well, good, because all these dead mice out there are it keeps me up at night.
Yeah. So. It's like the best way to describe it is IV ECMO. That's what I'm trying to do, is IV ECMO.
That sounds sweet. So Jared and I were getting ready to record this month, and we said we need somebody with some street cred, somebody with some actual ultrasound knowledge. So we asked around, and I think all the ultrasound faculty drew straws, and thank you, Lori Stoltz, for picking the short straw. We're so happy to have you here. We literally gave her, 15 minutes notice, maybe?
Only because she took 15 minutes to get over here.
I dawdled.
we're very happy to have Laurie here. Thank you for helping us out, because what we're going to be talking about this month is ultrasound guided resuscitation. We kind of go back and forth of doing, here's some basic stuff, strokes, here's PEs, things that, you know, are pretty bread and butter, and then this is kind of a new frontier thing of doing more ultrasound to figure out what's happening to your patient in real time. So Jared, you came up with this ultrasound flow sheet, hemodynamic ultrasound. I've termed it ultrasound guided hemodynamic resuscitation, or UGG resuscitation, because that's what I felt, and that's what a lot of people felt when they looked at that flow chart and went, ugh, I have no idea what this means. And I asked you about it, and your response was, if you don't do this, you're killing people.
Actually, my first response was probably not appropriate for this family program. The second response was that one.
So let's kind of start from the beginning. So the whole point of why you came up with this is to try to point in the direction of, you want adequate fluid resuscitation, and you need to know when to switch to pressors, when to switch to something else in your resuscitation. When do you need to go from missiles to guns? Is that correct?
Yeah, well, I guess it's a little. There's a little more context than that. Let me wax philosophic for a minute. So, historically, when we resuscitated people, we had physical exam, and all of the physical exam stuff we did was to try to look at tissue perfusion and what the heart and lungs were doing.
Can I tell you how happy I am that we don't do that anymore?
Yeah, exactly. So then we started looking at invasive ways to guess what the heart and lungs are doing. We used swans, and then people said, oh, swans are killing people because people don't know how to use them. So let's look at just CVP and A-line tracings. And those are to try to guess what the heart and lungs are doing. But now we have ultrasound. And why guess what the heart's doing when you just look at it and see exactly what it's doing? You can make non-invasive measurements. And this even bore out, I think it was like 2004, when Anand Kumar looked at things like CVP, wedge pressure, changes in CVP, changes in wedge pressure, to try to look at the response to the stroke volume index of the left ventricle. And he found that none of that correlated. And the only thing that correlated was the LVOT VTI on echo, correlated with what the actual cardiac index would do if you challenged the left ventricle. So we know that ultrasounding the heart can tell you what the heart's doing, more so than all of the guesswork that we used to do previously. And even in terms of volume responsiveness, you look at A-line tracings and variability and whatnot, all of that is trying to do distally exactly what you look at when you look at the heart with ultrasound. Okay, now, globally, our specialty has always been the leader in point-of-care ultrasound. We created the wheel, right? Would you agree with that, Laurie?
On point-of-care ultrasound?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So 5 years ago, if you graduate an emergency medicine residency and you go into a critical care fellowship, you automatically are the best at ultrasound. We have a bunch of yes-no diagnostic questions, typically, for emergency medicine. But in the last 5 years, what's happened with critical care, we've said, can we answer physiologic questions with point-of-care ultrasound? Instead of is there, isn't there, it's should we, shouldn't we? And a lot of the critical care societies have come up with their guidelines on critical care echocardiography and whatnot. And most of it is irrelevant. Most of it, you don't need to know. What you really need to know is, should I change my resuscitation somehow?
Well, and to back up even further, like, we have a test that is repeatable, non-invasive, safe, cheap, immediately available. I mean, these are the things that we say about all ultrasound,
right.
all of the reasons of why we do point-of-care ultrasound.
Right.
And that's what makes it brilliant. I mean, I am biased, but why not? We know how to do these things. We know that they are sensitive and specific for what we're looking for. So it really begs the question, why wouldn't you, if you know how to do these things? You know, we did this lawsuit study, our section, a couple of years ago, where we looked at a national database of all lawsuits and related to any point-of-care ultrasound performed by emergency physicians. And the findings were most surprising in that the cases that showed up were ones where ultrasound could have been performed and was not. Now, some of the cases, it's a little bit of a stretch that a regular emergency physician in the community would have performed said ultrasound exam. But like, for instance, a young girl post-syncope on OCPs, they just did a chest x-ray and an EKG. Could they have done a bedside echo and seen RV strain? A missed a liver laceration in a kid. They just did blood work and no FAST exam. They didn't do any other imaging. So those are the only types of studies that showed up. There were no studies that said, hey, an emergency physician used ultrasound and they used it incorrectly, or they used it and they made an error in interpretation or an error in image acquisition. That's just not what's happening. So it's indefensible legally, but also to your patients, that you have this resource available and you choose not to use it.
Yeah. But from the critical care perspective on the world, we have these enigmas that we don't know how to resolve, right? So the patient comes in with a PE and they're hypotensive. If you give them fluid, you're going to make them worse. If somebody comes in with heart failure and you treat them the same way you would treat somebody who doesn't have heart failure, you could make them worse. And so how do you alter your resuscitation? Well, the perfect way to do that is with ultrasound. Instead of asking, is there tamponade or not, or is there an effusion or not, can I proceed with my resuscitation the way I wanted to, or do I need to change it somehow?
And now, like, hemodynamic ultrasound is yet another modality that we have available. You know how to do it.
Right.
You should be doing it on every person.
The interesting response has been, instead of, yeah, we are the specialty that we own point of care ultrasound, this is within our wheelhouse, let's just do this, we'll learn these skills and incorporate it, it's been, you can do that, but I'm not going to do that. And we really spent a lot of time, and we worked on this for like a year, trying to come up with, all right, these are the questions that we need to answer that would change your resuscitation. What is the best way and the most simplest way to reliably answer those questions?
Well, and there are growing pains, right? Because even within, like, hemodynamic ultrasound and volume responsiveness, the literature goes back and forth, and, you know, there, some people are on one side of a camp, and I think that the ultrasound community in general are still getting their feet on the ground as to what's the most appropriate methods for even evaluating ejection fraction or RV strain. I mean, those things we've built this picture. The image is becoming clearer, but when it comes to volume responsiveness, the image is not clear.
Yeah.
And so that's what makes it hard. But that also does not give us any excuses to not go ahead and do what we know already. The algorithm that we have, and Aaron and I had this conversation in a hallway once. It is overreaching. It is
that's my style.
But it's good. I mean, we're an academic institution, right? We're one of the few academic institutions that have a critical care fellowship and an ultrasound fellowship. I would like to say we lead the nation, but we have to push that envelope.
I'll say it. We lead the nation. Because I don't know one way or another. So.
Well, and that's our job, to push those borders. And I get it that I don't think that most of the attendings or residents in our department feel comfortable with the algorithm. However, that doesn't mean that it's not useful, and that doesn't mean that it's not going to change patient outcomes. I am personally of the opinion that it's pie in the sky. It's advanced. It's what we're reaching for. And even if you only get a little bit of the way down the algorithm, you are doing patients a big service.
I have a couple of comments about that. One is, you're right, a lot of this stuff is very nuanced, and we tried to boil it down. put it on a spoon and cook it down to its purest form to try to answer some of these questions. But I had this conversation with one of the heart failure cardiologists, and she was saying, dude, heart failure cardiologists don't even agree on some of this stuff on echo. So we had to come up with what we thought were the best way to answer the questions that we have in terms of resuscitating people. Number two, 5 years ago, when we started talking about TAPSE, everyone had the same response.
Everybody was like, oh my God, how am I going to do that?
And now it's just no big deal. People measure TAPSE.
Right. And TAPSE is also very well respected. We can use that language now with our critical care fellows and with our cardiology colleagues. It's now the language that we speak.
Yeah, and the third comment is, we have these questions that we need to ask that would change resuscitation. And it might not be an exhaustive list of questions, but it's the most common things that you would change resuscitation for. And the typical scenario is, for the majority of your patients, do whatever you want. They're going to be fine just based on the bell curve distribution. However, when you have these people on either end of the bell curve, what's been happening is people get 2, 3, 4, 10 liters of fluid. They don't get better. At some point, somebody wanders in there and wanders around the chest with the ultrasound probe and says, I shouldn't have done that. And if you're not going to do it the right way, you shouldn't do it at all.
Yeah.
And not doing it at all is going to hurt people, which is why my comment to you was why it was.
So let's kind of, I'll tell you why we came to this. I made it a point we would never talk about ultrasound on the podcast because our ultrasound faculty hate being on podcasts. And because it's very visual. It's like watching somebody else playing a video game, only worse. It would be listening to somebody else play a video game to talk about ultrasound. However, this algorithm, when it first came out, my response is, I'm not going to do that. And I had my very first moment of, I'm being left behind. Stuff is happening in emergency medicine, and I don't know what's going on, so I'm just going to reject it. And that made me feel very, very bad. So what I'd like to talk about is just going through the different parts of this algorithm in order to say, from I don't know anything about an ultrasound, I don't know what end to put the gel on, all the way to I feel very comfortable in ultrasound, but I'd like to learn a little bit more, to see what are we going to do at each of these steps. So the very first step is you've got your four views that you're going to take a look at, and step one is basically to do a parasternal long access view. Put the probe on the chest, put it over the sternum, get a parasternal long access view, and look to see, is there LV or RV dysfunction? To make it even simpler, is the heart beating too hard, is it not beating hard enough, or is it beating fairly normal? Is that simplified enough for me?
And there is actually good data that your eyeball assessment of whether it's normal, hyperdynamic, or hypodynamic is very good. They have compared it to cardiology performed echo, where they do volumetric measurements of the LV in systole and diastole, all different kinds of methods, and your gestalt equals those other tests. So you can trust that. That's a skill developed over time, unfortunately, and requires repetition, but that's why we push the envelope, and that's why we want everybody to scan all the time.
So I'm going to put the probe on the chest. I take a look at it. I go, man, that heart looks like it is really being flogged right now in a patient that's showing shock. What am I going to do?
I guess what you need to do, the first thing you do is just look at the LV. First of all, is the LV look normal in terms of thickness? If your LV is like 2 inches thick, the myocardium is 2 inches thick, then they probably have longstanding hypertension, probably going to have diastolic dysfunction or at risk for diastolic dysfunction. You need to take it into consideration. Conversely, if the LV takes up the entire screen and is barely moving, then you need to think they've got a systolic dysfunction, they've got a contractility problem, I'm not going to flog them with fluid. The majority of the patients, the question is going to be, oh, LV looks okay, it's just hyperdynamic. Then it's, do I need to give them fluid or not?
Okay, so I've got a heart that's not beating very well. I'm probably going to move to pressors to try to help push that heart a little bit harder.
Depend. It doesn't mean that they wouldn't respond to volume. It just means that you have a very high likelihood of A, blowing out the RV because of LV failure, or B, putting it all in the lungs. So So I would argue that you need to be considering an inotrope or early presser along with gentle fluid resuscitation. Instead of your unit of currency being 2 liters, make it 250.
And your repeat ultrasound can be your ticket there. So I had a patient on my last shift who had known longstanding severe CHF, and he was a GI bleeder, and he was really hypotensive, and we echoed him, and he certainly was volume down. And so rather than giving him, you know, blood and fluids right out of the gates, whole hog, or restricting that, we just did it lightly, and then we rechecked. Mm-hmm. And then we checked again, and he could tolerate more, and then he got more, and then he stabilized. So he didn't even need pressors.
Right.
But it informed our decision-making
right.
in both directions.
Yeah, you changed your resuscitation, and it worked out great. You might change which fluid you give, change how much fluid you give, change the order of pressors to fluids. It depends. The point is, you saw something, you changed your resuscitation, and it worked out.
So when I'm looking at this little old lady that I would normally say, I don't know, give her 250, I can actually look on ultrasound and see that her heart does not squeeze. It kind of like maybe turns a little bit, but doesn't really squeeze and go, yeah, I was right. Mm-hmm. I've got something I can actually look at and say, all right, this heart is not going to do well with a bunch of fluids because it's not squeezing well. Versus a heart that's hyperdynamic that I say, man, that heart probably needs a little bit of extra preload, some more fluid, some more volume behind it in order to keep going. And then I look again. And I think that's the most important thing to reiterate is that one bedside ultrasound is not going to be enough. If you're resuscitating somebody, you got to go back and check your work. You got to see what you've done.
Right. And let me comment on the hyperdynamic LV for a second. So here's a typical scenario that we see in the wintertime during flu season. Somebody gets H1N1, gets pneumonia, gets ARDS. 25% of patients with ARDS have acute right heart failure. So they come in a little hypotensive, creatinine's a little bit bumped, LV looks hyperdynamic because they have right heart failure, and the LV always looks hyperdynamic in that scenario. So people say 2 liters of saline, and then it makes the RV worse, and now you're more hypotensive, and now your pulmonary edema is getting worse, and so you run into this spiral, and nobody ever does the bedside echo. So if you have a really hyperdynamic LV, the questions are, would they respond to fluid, and do they have RV dysfunction? That's why you need the peristernal short axis, where you just rotate the probe and see if the septum's flat or not.
So let's talk about that real quick. So you do the peristernal long axis, and I think anybody that looks has ever seen, watched a movie where there's a baby being born could look at an ultrasound and go, oh, that's a baby, and that flickering thing is the heart. And I think that we all feel comfortable looking at the heart and saying that heart's beating too hard, not beating enough. Now we go to the peristernal short access view, and I'm looking to see if there's pressure or volume overload. So what am I looking at now in order to determine whether there's pressure or volume overload on this short access view?
To make it really simple,
please,
RV size and RV squeeze. Those are the main things that I'm looking for. So when you get your apical 4, you want your RV to be less than half the LV. They're size-wise. So if it's approaching the size of the LV, then that's way too big. And then measure a TAPSE. I do like the peristernal short to look for the septal flattening as well. But the main things that I'm looking at are just RV function on the apical 4 and the TAPSE as well.
Yeah, I think in terms of the peristernal short, what you want to know is, so the RV is a low pressure chamber, so the septum should be slave to the high pressure chamber, which is the LV. So it should always do what the LV wants it to do. So if it flattens with systole, that means the pressure in the RV is exceeding the LV during systole and the septum's flat.
And you're real far gone by then.
Right. So that's pressure overload. Volume overload is during diastole if the septum flattens because the RV is filling, the pressure is going high, it's pushing the septum over. So if you see either of those things, if you see neither of those things, then you're fine to proceed in terms of the RV. If you see either of those things, then you need to say, do I have systolic dysfunction, and that's where you look at the test.
Well, and that should be, and if you're seeing either of those things, and if peristyle is short, that should be a great big stop sign to you.
Yes.
But there can be lesser degrees of RV dysfunction that you're picking up on your TAPSE or your global assessment.
So if I, and I feel like most of our residents, faculty, they can do parasternal long axis, parasternal short axis, and take a look at the heart. I feel very comfortable looking at those two views and saying, all right, that heart is beating too hard, it's not beating hard enough, and looking at the short axis and saying, that is a giant RV. Oh, okay, that RV is okay. So if I get to step two, I see a giant RV. Now I'm going through my mind of, you know, is this an issue with pulmonary hypertension, a big PE, or is this, just fluid overload because the heart's just not pushing anything?
Well, yeah, you have to take all this into context. The most common reason for RV failure is LV failure. So if on your long axis the LV looks terrible, either the myocardium's 2 inches thick or you have a 10% EF type of contractility, that's probably the cause of your RV failure. You need to treat the LV. So you have a PE patient. PE patient comes in, acute RV failure, pressure volume overloaded. I would guarantee you that many people, not to sound like Trump, but many people would say, okay, it looks big on ultrasound, I think it's a PE. Let's just give a little fluid anyway. Right?
Yeah.
What the next question is, can I get fluid? And that's how you answer this question is, what you need to see is, what is the TAPSE and what is the speed of contractility before the pulmonic valve opens? Okay, that's the IVV, the isovolumetric contraction velocity. If the TAPSE is normal, so in some patients, well, the TAPSE can be high because it's being tugged on by the LV, which is why you need the IVV. So if your IVV is greater than 10, that means you have some reserve to your RV. It might respond to a little fluid. If your IVV is less than 10, it's done. The only thing that you can do to improve that patient's hemodynamics is to reduce the RV afterload with vasodilators.
So I'm going to back up for a little bit because I think that half of our audience just tried to drive their car into a tree trying to figure out what all of these
acronyms mean. Understood, but this matters.
No. I don't disagree that it matters, but if I only speak Japanese and you're trying to explain it to me in Arabic, then it's not going to work.
Right.
So let me try to bring this back and say this in English. So I take a look at my heart. It's beating too fast. It's not beating enough. I take a look at my RV, and my RV is blown out. The next thing I need to do is determine, is this a patient that either needs more fluids, will respond, or needs afterload reducers?
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So in order to do that, that's where I would do the TAPSE.
TAPSE and IVV.
Okay. So, Lori, can you tell us a little bit about TAPSE, what TAPSE stands for, and the appropriate way to measurement and what it's going to tell us when we look at it?
So it's tricuspid anterior plane systolic excursion. So you're looking at the distance that the tricuspid annulus is moving during systole. And your ultrasound probe is at the apex when you're doing it, and that is how the heart is beating. The apex is a fixed location, and the RV is actually contracting in its direction. Now, the tricuspid annulus, you place your, I do it in M mode. You can also do it with tissue Doppler. M mode is easy. I hope y'all out there know what M mode is. But you put your M mode line on the lateral aspect of the tricuspid valve in the tissue. So you don't want it on the valve, you want it on the annulus. And then you hit your M mode, and then you're just measuring the distance between where that tricuspid annulus is in diastole and where it is in systole.
And so you should have a greater TAPSE if you've got issues with
good
RV. Yeah, if you've got good excursion, good movement. You will have a low TAPSE if your RV is strained. It's not going to be moving that much because it's not moving much in diastole. So you're going to have a lower TAPSE if you're having strain, a higher TAPSE if you're not having strain.
Yes,
think about it like this. The RV contracts more longitudinally. It contracts from base to apex, and you can measure that with the TAPSE. So if you think about the RV as one muscle, how far it contracts is the TAPSE, right? So it, as the pressure increases or as the strain increases, it's not going to contract as far, right? Just like any other muscle. Now, what comes right before the TAPSE is how much force can that muscle generate, right? Does it just need a little bit of help, or can it just not generate enough force to move? And that's what the next measurement, the IVV, is.
Okay, so explain to me the IVV. How are we measuring this, and what is it telling me that's changing my management?
Same view, probes in the cursor is in the same spot. Instead of M mode, it's tissue Doppler, and you're looking at the first upward reflection.
I'll be perfectly honest with you, I don't like ever use IVV.
You should.
And I'll tell you why. Because as far as like this algorithm has already, we're down to like number four. You have answered 85 to 90% of what you need to know already as an emergency physician. And just numbers-wise, I mean, how many sick patients do you get per shift? A handful. How many of them, like, by the time you then take 80% of that, you've already ultrasounded them. You're left with very few that you're making these really fine decision points on. I don't want to lose the forest for the trees for most of our colleagues, because most of what you need to know is incredibly simple, and you've already gotten that information up to this point. I would say diastology makes up 18% of the rest of it, and I have a lot of empathy for our group in particular, because ultrasound is and critical care is just like lightning speed advancing, and what we ask our emergency medicine attendings to do is legit almost a fellowship in ultrasound just to get their level 3 credentials. It is, they're like nearly ready for RDMS by the time they have their level 3 credentials. So our standard of what everybody should be doing with ultrasound is incredibly high. So I just want to publicly say I have a lot of empathy. It is difficult to rise to the bar that we have set, but if you even like make a tiny leap to get up to that bar, you will be way ahead in your patient care.
I hear you. You and I have argued about stuff for years, so I like
disgusting.
I like arguing with you. I am less empathetic. Because
that's your nature?
Well, I do think that we ask a lot of people. The reason I lose my empathy is the resistance to learn it. And I think
I don't have empathy for resistance to learning.
Well, I guess let me say this. Yes, in this algorithm, when you're talking about RV stuff, by the time you get to this point, 95, maybe 99% of your patients aren't going to need this. But it's the one that did need it that you're going to remember. You know, and so when you get down to even TAPSE doesn't tell you can I or can't I. It just tells you you should think about it, that you have to answer that question. And so that's why I think you need the IVV. And you're right, you might go 5 years without ever needing it. But the one time you did is the time you're going to remember. And that's why I want to do this.
Well, and absolutely. Like, we don't train on airways for every shift, right? It's for that once in 5 years.
So I think you make a good point. Lori makes a good point that ultrasound and critical care are really starting to take off. The amount of stuff that we can do compared to what we could do 10 years ago, as medicine continues to do, you know, just increases exponentially. So if you're behind the way I feel I am now, then you got to start somewhere. And so for me to look at all this, I go, ah, I'm overwhelmed. Okay, let's start from the beginning. I need to put the probe on the chest. I look at the heart. Is it beating funny? Yes or no? Then I look, is there an RV problem? If there is an RV problem, then the next thing is a TAPSE. And I'll be honest, I don't do TAPSEs that much, but I can learn how to do that. And I think this kind of having like a pyramid style of the majority of your patients will benefit from you putting the ultrasound on the chest and looking at the heart. And then even more, even a little bit less will benefit from looking and determining, is there an RV problem? But a fair amount will. And then TAPSE. And then that other portion that's going to need the VVTI are ones that you can get to. So I'm not saying don't learn it. I'm saying if you got to prioritize this stuff because you don't know anything about it, that's a good way to prioritize it.
Yeah. I mean, I get it that people are busy and this is hard or whatnot. But I just think try, you know, and over time you'll learn. What I don't want to see is people say, I'm just going to wander, send the resus captain in there to look, do the echo and look at the IVC. You know, we got to move that train forward.
Jared's like the parent that's like, you will do this. And I'm like the parent that's like, you can do it.
That's why I'm glad you're both here. All right, so let's go back the other way. So let's go back. You do your parasternal short axis view. The RV looks fine. There's no problem with it. Now your question is, can I give more volume or do I need to do pressures? And that's where you look for volume responsiveness.
Do that however you want to. Whatever way you want to. This is not a volume responsiveness question. Do whatever the hell you want to. I personally think that LVOT VTI is the best for a couple reasons. One, it is directly measuring what's coming out of the left ventricle, right? It's exactly what you're getting on your A-line tracing. You're looking at basically the stroke volume, right? Number two, it's the same view as every other one of these measurements. So you could, if you wanted to, you could bang out all of these measurements, same view, 30 seconds.
I think that's a great advocacy for this, but
to be the counter voice, so in good studies that have looked at LVOT VTI and reproducibility between providers and within one provider, it performs very poorly, unfortunately.
Predicting stroke volume or volume responsiveness?
Just measuring LVOT VTI compared to a gold standard. Less than 50% of the time are you even reproducible in a patient that hasn't changed.
So if I am looking for volume responsiveness, according to what you're saying, and I take this measurement and I say, yeah, they're volume responsive, let's give them some more fluids, and I come back and measure it again, I may get a completely different number that has nothing to do with their response to fluids.
The measure of LVOT VTI is very, very difficult to reproduce accurately on a consistent basis. And even these studies were performed by echocardiographers. So we're not even talking about and emergency medicine physicians, residents. So that's what makes it challenging. That being said, don't stop trying. I still use it upon occasion. I still hope that I'm getting accurate measures. I think it's a good adjunct for other measures. Just like everything else, you know, you put together the picture of what you're seeing from several different sources of information, and this is an accessible source of information.
That is an important point, right? This is by no means exhaustive. This is trying to take a very complex scenario and boil it down into simple questions that you could try to answer reasonably well in a few simple steps, right? I mean, you don't think it's simple, but there are a few simple steps. When you look at the complexity of all the echocardiographic assessment that goes into these questions. My counter to your counter on LVOT VTI is that I don't think you have to measure it. I think you just look at the peaks, the peak velocity with respiration, because if you have to measure, it's probably not there, right? But if you look at the peaks, that's basically systolic pressure variation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can look at the variation.
Right.
Absolutely.
That's what I
mean. Yeah. And, you know, we have looked at this a lot within our group, too, and we're looking at, like, carotid measures. I think that the jury is definitely still out on this one. But LVOT VTI is... it is still respected despite its bad rap in the literature and its poor reproducibility.
Yeah. I think the point is do whatever you want to assess volume responsiveness.
So the other option, and the one that I was taught and the one that I use, is looking at the IVC and looking for collapsibility during respiration.
And looking at the IVC is akin to a screening test, like a dimer. So if it's very collapsible, you have some information. If it's very plethoric, you have some information. If it's anywhere in between, you can't exclude the other two. So that's how I use IVC, and that's how I teach the resident.
And I think that's fair, because when we're looking at somebody who in front of us is really sick, I want to look and be reassured by stuff. If I've got somebody in front of me that's got chest pain, the first thing I'm going to do is take a history. And if their history is, I got punched in the chest, okay, well, my suspicion is a lot lower. But if their history is starting to sound more anginal, I'm not convinced they don't have an MI. Now I need to do my exam and get an EKG. And if the EKG is concerning, man, I'm still not convinced. Now I need to interpret the troponins and figure out. And if the troponins are indeterminate, I'm still not convinced. We need more tests. And I feel like it's very similar with this. There are some people that come in diaphoretic with the Levine sign, with their casino winnings in their hand, and you go, okay, you are having an MI. Like, you are a stereotypical MI. The same as you could put the probe on the chest and say, that heart is not moving. This is bad. But the more you say, I'm not quite sure, you do need to know more to make the right decision. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I think CVP and VTI are different ends of the same spectrum. So you're both of them are trying to look at cardiopulmonary interactions. IVC variability is looking at pre-heart lung. LVOT VTI is looking at post-heart lung. Both of them are trying to figure out what's going to happen in the interim period. Now, I will say the benefit of VTI is that as you get doing this and you do more of these, if you see some tiny little blip for an LVO VTI, you know, that stroke volume sucks, right? And maybe you need an inotrope or something.
Okay. So going down from that, if you're volume responsive, great. Now you're recommending we do diastology. So tell me about what we're looking for now.
So I recommend if on that first view, the peristernal lung axis, if the left atrium is big and the myocardium's thick and they've got longstanding hypertension and you know they're on an antihypertensive, you need to know, although they appear to be volume responsive, if I give that, is the path of least resistance for that fluid back into the lungs? Right? And the majority of heart failure is diastolic heart failure, especially the older people get. And so you don't need to answer, do they have diastolic dysfunction? You don't care about that. What you care about is, do they have, quote unquote, restrictive physiology to where the fluid is going to go back into the lungs, high left atrial pressure. The single best, if you look at the echocardiography books, the single best measurement to indicate the presence of significant diastolic dysfunction is the E prime. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I have to say, when it comes to diastology, this is something that I personally have evolved in how I approach it in the last just year or two. I totally drink the Kool-Aid now. You start looking just as practice, because your fellows are get really into diastology, and then you have to know what you're talking about. So that's my case, and then you start to see it more, and you start to see it in your patient outcomes, and you start to then start making decisions based on what you're seeing. So I highly recommend that you guys just start trying it. I carry in my phone a PDF of, and we can send it out, a PDF of all of the waveforms for diastology. Diastology gets very complicated. There's many things to look at. The measures that you get can be conflicting with each other. So it's another one of those scenarios where you have to take the whole picture into account. You might, in a in important cases, you're probably going to get a clear picture of what's going on, and you might get a lot of conflicting information from the information that you're gathering. But I carry the actual PDF, and I refer to it every time, because I'm looking at the inflow velocities and the waveforms of those, the peaks, the peak velocities, and then looking at the tissue Doppler.
Yeah, what the question I want to know is, do I change my resuscitation, right? Do I need to afterload reduce them instead of give them fluid? The best way to answer that is, well, I guess what you want to know is how compliant is your left ventricle. So if you look at the actual measurement here, so this is for the E prime, it's tissue Doppler of the lateral wall of the mitral annulus. And remember in the RV, we did that same measurement, only instead of looking at speed of contraction that we did with RV, we're looking at the speed of relaxation with the LV. Okay, so if your E prime is less than 10, notice that the number is the same as in the RV. If E prime is less than 10, then you know that your left ventricle isn't that compliant. The speed of relaxation is very slow. So that tells you that you're going to give fluid to a stiff left ventricle. It might end up in the left atrium. And if that is the case, then the follow-up question, so say your lady that you had the world's worst ER doctor on, the elderly lady with AFib and on an antihypertensive, well, no, she probably has diastolic dysfunction. Okay, does she have restrictive physiology that I can't give her fluid? So you do an E prime, you do the parasternal long axis, LV's thick, left atrium's big, she's in AFib, those are all indicators of it, so you need to look for it. You do the E prime, it's 8, you know, okay, I have a significantly non-compliant left ventricle. Is the left atrial pressure high? And that's the next question with the E to A. When you look at the mitral inflow velocities, same view, you just move the indicator over a little bit.
Yeah, and what you're getting at with your E to A greater than 2, you're really looking at extremes. You're not necessarily looking for that patient that has, mild diastolic dysfunction or even like a pseudonormalization kind of pattern. You're really looking for extremes,
right.
which simplifies this. And I think when it comes to critical care, the extremes are what matters. I think one of the best things that residents can do is just also look at old echoes and compare.
At this point, the recording of Fistfight broke out as we had a gang of angry ED docs with pitchforks and torches descend on the studio. Actually, my computer just crashed. But we covered the majority of the important clinical parts and probably way too much of the philosophical parts. We finished this discussion without the tape rolling, and I'll try to summarize that here. Ultrasound is great. It's renewable, it's not radiating, it's dynamic, you can do it in real time, it's available to a growing number of EDs, it's fantastic. But there's also a steep learning curve, as the test characteristics are all dependent on the operator. So emergency medicine, ultrasound, and critical care are all taking giant leaps forward each year, and even common terms like pulseless electrical activity are now more difficult to define because of the availability of ultrasound. So as the specialty changes, we have to change with it. 15 years ago, everyone swore by CVP as a measure of volume status. Now not so much. Push-dose pressors were all the rage for a while. Now, not so much. But ideas like apneic oxygenation, delayed sequence intubation are starting to be shown in studies to be effective and safer than what we've, quote, known to be true for quite some time. So where will UGG resuscitation be in this group? I don't know. Is this algorithm going to stand the test of time? Absolutely not. There's no way. It's going to change quite a bit, and I wouldn't be surprised if it changes in the next couple months. Manny Rivers of the Rivers Trial for Early Goal-Directed Therapy gave us a grand round several years back, and he said, and I paraphrase very loosely, people keep bashing my protocol, saying you don't need to do it to get the outcome. I don't care which protocol you use or what parts of the protocol you use, just do something and reassess the patient and don't stick them in a corner and let them die. So I'll give the Manny Rivers style answer. Put the probe on the chest, intervene, put the probe back on the chest, reassess. So I did this myself after throwing a fit for a month saying I wasn't going to do this. And I had a 15-year-old girl with tachycardia and compensated shock from some unknown source. To this day, I still don't know why she was in shock. I gave her the standard 20 ml per kilo bolus, and she didn't respond. In fact, she got worse. Started dropping her blood pressure. So I put the probe on her chest. She was hyperdynamic with a flat IVC, so I gave her more fluids because I could see that she could handle it. And I felt safe doing that because now I had something measurable rather than, well, let's see if she gets pulmonary edema and then we'll know we gave her too much. Serial ultrasound showed a more plump IVC and a less hyperdynamic heart, and after 5 liters of fluids, she was stable. And 5 liters of fluids is a lot. I wouldn't be comfortable giving that without some way to reassess that my interventions are actually helping and not hurting. Now, I can't do all this stuff in this protocol right now, but I can learn slowly. So I hope the way we've laid it out for you helps you to prioritize your learning if you feel like I do about cardiac ultrasound. Start with the basics. You will make a difference just understanding the basics. And then progress, little by little, until we actually figure out what protocol is going to be the most effective. Now, medicine is changing in general. And to transition out of this episode, we asked Dr. Peter Rosen to give us his thoughts on the progress of medicine throughout his career. So before you say, "That's too difficult, I can't do that," just listen to some of the things Dr. Rosen has witnessed throughout his lifetime.
Tell everybody, go ahead and tell everybody, I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am, yes, I am, yes, I am.
I gave a talk last week in Boston about art and science and medicine, which I probably ought to give here sometime. As I look at science in medicine, it's different from what we know science to be in other major fields like physics or chemistry. We don't have a body of theory that's based on falsified experiments. What we have instead in medicine is a science of problem solving. If we look back during my lifetime and what we can do as physicians, what we couldn't do 80 years ago, it's pretty remarkable. In my lifetime, we have antibiotics, we have blood transfusions, we have all kinds of surgical procedures that didn't even exist, but which in fact are quality and quantity of life-saving. We have treatment of diseases that we had no therapies for. We have extension of diseases that used to be instant killers. And I think that on the whole, we've done a tremendous job in medicine. Obviously, we've had our disappointments. And obviously, some of the things that looked like they were going to be very promising have not evolved, like the human genome. That was really exciting. We were going to define disease by genetic analysis, and that was going to enable us to fix things that we had neither therapy for nor prevention for. And it was a wonderful idea. The problem is, the more we study genetics, the more we realize that knowing the genome isn't enough. We have to know the epigenetics. I heard a really fascinating lecture here a couple of years ago put on by the science department of the University of Arizona. They have a science series lectures every year. And the epigenetics is just fantastic because we don't know really what is genetic and what is chemical stimulus of a change in a genetic capacity or enabling a gene to express something it wasn't before then. Like I learned in microbiology in medical school that E. coli could not grow in a lactose medium because it was unable to secrete an enzyme called beta-galactosidase. theoretically didn't have the enzyme for it. But lo and behold, when you put the E. coli into a lactose medium, there would be a drop in numbers, and then all of a sudden it would rise again to normal. And what had happened was the E. coli that had no ability to express beta-galactosidase and developed one. Was that a new gene mutation, or was it just an expression of a gene that was already there, the epigenetics? And I think it's the latter. And we certainly have experienced something similar with antibiotic resistance. So the science of medicine is still mostly oriented towards problem solving. And because of a lot of sociology and politics, we're no longer capable of attacking problems like we once did. So I think our new knowledge is going to slow down, and our problems are not going to be solved in a way that they need to be. And I think that's a shame. But maybe the pendulum will swing back someday. But overall, to answer your question, I'm very excited about what medicine has accomplished in my lifetime, and particularly in my lifetime as a physician.
Hi, thanks for having me on the podcast. My name is Dan Falvey. I graduated from the University of Arizona a little over 2 years ago. Since that time, I've been working at a busy level 2 trauma center in Florida. We see a little over 100,000 patients a year. About 30% of that is seen as pediatrics in a separate dedicated PCD. We have every major subspecialty except for burn. And so that's kind of the practice setting I work in. And I was asked to talk about what ultrasound is like, sort of outside of the academic setting at a place like where I'm working currently. And ultrasound is pretty far behind, I would say, definitely at least what's going on at the University of Arizona. Most hospitals in the area do not have 24-hour intensivist coverage. Our hospital just did get 24-hour ICU doctors in-house about maybe 6 or 8 months ago. They still really don't have an ultrasound machine upstairs. They do have a linear probe for placing lines, but there's nothing else really. The EDs is the only place that really has any kind of ultrasound, point-of-care ultrasound in the whole hospital. When I started, we had about a 10-year-old sauna site, which was literally duct-taped together. The probe was falling off if you remove the duct tape. And then there's one newer M-Turbo, which is functional. I went to a bunch of meetings and helped our department purchase a Zonari machine. And there's a lot of excitement from my colleagues, and they're constantly asking me to help with this or that type of ultrasound. And then they always say, I really need to take a course at the end. So the one thing I would say to the residents is to make sure you learn it all during residency, so that you don't have to be one of those guys that says, man, I need to waste my CME money and time to take an ultrasound course. So I'll talk a little bit about the algorithm that Jared and others put together. Looking at it, I think it is very complex, and it's honestly probably not needed for the majority of the patients. But I do like it. I think that's kind of the essence of our specialty, right? 1 out of 1,000 headaches has the subarachnoid, and that's kind of what we're set up to look for. And then when you do find it, to know how to resuscitate them and how to care for them. And so, obviously the majority of the patients aren't going to need, such a detailed and specific algorithm. But for the ones who do, it's nice to know how to do what you're doing. I'll be honest, I don't use everything in that algorithm, but I haven't even really heard of the IVV. I mean, I'm excited to learn about it, and I've been reading about it and stuff since I saw this algorithm, but that's not something that I typically do. I'll tell you a little bit about what I do when a sick patient comes in. And the first thing I do is I start by looking at the lungs. I was a little bit surprised that there was nothing regarding lung ultrasound in this algorithm, because to me, one of the things you're concerned about when you're bolusing fluid is that they're going to develop worsening pulmonary edema, and lung ultrasound is way easier than any type of cardiac views. And I think it does change your management. I'll tell you, last week I had a patient who came in by EMS, completely altered, couldn't provide any history. The only history I had from paramedics was that he takes Lasix for CHF and that he has bad COPD as well. He's setting 80% with a good waveform on good dose of, or good settings of BiPAP with 100% FiO2. And so I was asking the nurses to get preparation to intubate as I'm ultrasounding his heart. And I noticed that he didn't have any sliding signs on the left side and probably had a big pneumothorax. It changed my management of, I was going to intubate that patient before the chest x-ray, and that could have been really bad. I didn't have the confidence to put in the chest tube based only on the ultrasound because I didn't know if that was, there was a large bleb or something else going on. But as soon as the chest x-ray resulted, I put in a pigtail, and the patient, about an hour later, was on nasal cannula and talking and doing quite well. And I think things could have gone much differently if I had intubated them, before the chest x-ray, which was my plan, to be honest, before the ultrasound. So I start with the lung ultrasound, and then I start by looking at the structure and function of the LV and RV and looking at TAPSE. And look at the RV and the parasternal short axis. And then I do look at the IVC and kind of using those findings together, looking if it's somebody who I feel like you obviously can't give fluid to, and you want to start off with pressors, or somebody who you obviously, it's safe to give fluid to. And then for everyone else, which, is a lot of patients, right now for me, it's depending on how good of views I'm getting. So if I am getting great views, I will look at the variability of the LVOT, VTI, and look at the diastology and, see if that can guide my resuscitation. And if I can't get good views, what I've typically been doing, if we have good peripheral IV access, is starting low dose levofed, giving a gentle fluid bolus of maybe 500 cc's, and reassessing and seeing what happens. So that's kind of my algorithm. But I would echo what has been said by several other people on the podcast earlier, is that doing something is definitely better than doing nothing. And you're going to be the expert if you learn half of the things that's on this algorithm. You're going to be far and away the expert in whatever hospital you're working at, unless you're at a very specialized place like the University of Arizona. I'll give you one more example of a case I had fairly early on after completing residency. I had a patient who had been, homeless guy, been sitting outside, probably doing drugs, who knows what exactly, but was brought in tachycardic and hypotensive and hyperthermic, and had been given, was on his second liter of fluid by EMS. Presumed sepsis, and there's all these algorithms that are sort of forced upon you. We're supposed to give everyone 30 cc's per kilo, regardless of anything else. You have to give that, or else you get an email saying, you're a bad doctor, basically. And so right when he arrived, I put the ultrasound on him and saw that basically his heart wasn't beating at all like a normal 26-year-old. His TAPSE was, I think, 8, but very bad. His left ventricular systolic function was terrible. I sent him for a PE scan because he was so tachycardic and had been laying around. That was negative. And I called the cardiologist and said, I think we need a stat echo on this guy. I don't know if he has endocarditis or if he, something else is going on. His TAPSE is 8, I think, and he doesn't have a PE, and I don't know what's going on. Can help? And his response was, "What's TAPSE?" So, the cardiologist who's responsible for reading the echo doesn't even know what a TAPSE is, and I think that's sort of commonplace knowledge amongst everyone at the University of Arizona and people who follow emergency ultrasound. So I don't think you necessarily need to feel like you're a bad doctor if you can't do anything on Jared and everyone else's protocol, but you know, I do think it's important to do your best. And if you're doing something, you know, you're going to be helping your patient more than doing nothing. So that's about all I got. Thanks again for having me on.